All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
We have a very special guest on today's podcast. He is one of the most accomplished men in fantasy footy at the moment, and we are going to go deep and dissect his philosophies for fantasy footy. This is the Ball Boys. Let's go!
Hodge has done it from nowhere. Forced in the goal from inside the team. Sheed from the boundary. Dusty!
G'day and welcome again to the Ball Boys AFL Fantasy Podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Casey, and you can find me on Twitter at Ball Boys Fantasy. And today I've upgraded my co-host. I no longer have the rock weighing me down that is the coach of the Oxlongs, Luke. I've upgraded and I've brought on some serious talent to the show here. And that is one of the newest additions to the podcaster space. He's a content creator, and that is DT Lemon. Let's bring him on now. DT Lemon, welcome to the show, mate. It's an honor to have you on.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me on. Big fan of the show, and I love the chemistry you and Luke have bouncing back off each other. Hopefully, I can be almost be as good as that. I don't think I'll be able to rival what you guys have on the audio.
Or chemistry, schmemistry. This is we're upgrading here. Today's about a knowledgeable person like yourself coming on the show and dropping your knowledge for the rest of us, hopefully making our audience some better AFL fantasy coaches. Before we get stuck into the nitty gritty, for anyone who doesn't know, I want you to give our listeners an intro in terms of your fantasy pedigree, your story, specifically the last 4 years. I mean, you just have to go over to your Twitter page, and it's on your description there. Some pretty seriously impressive stats, mate. Talk us through your seasons over the past 4 years.
Yeah, so I've always played fantasy, but took it a bit more seriously 4 years ago. Started to listen to a few more podcasts and got on Twitter, and I was like, wow, there's a heap of information out there. It's actually it's a pretty fascinating game. And so, yeah, 4 years ago, I finished number three, just 7 points off the car, which was a little bit demoralizing, but still really, really happy with that. And then, yeah, since then, 271, 32, and then 375 last year. So all top 400. Got the second hat in 2023, which was nice. And yeah, it's been a pretty successful couple of years. So hopefully this year is another successful year. I'm sort of dreading that year that I have that maybe doesn't go as well. But we'll see when and if that occurs.
It's a very seriously impressive stretch, mate. I'm on the record saying that I think the fantasy classic space is as competitive as it ever has been. And to go 4 years in a row, top 400, couple of hats in there, a third place finished, and on the record a few, I think that was Holmesy's year, but a lot of people saying that if the season that year was a week longer, that you might have taken the thing out because your team was charging home that season. So lots of pedigree, lots of experience coming through you guys for this episode. And I just wanted to ask, we're talking about AFL fantasy, but prior to or as well as AFL fantasy, do you have any other like experience playing other fantasy sports at all?
I've dipped the toe into NFL fantasy, NBA fantasy before, back sort of through uni days. But I think AFL is always, that's the sport that I live and breathe. You know, I used to play a lot, watch as many games as I can. So I think the key to fantasy sports is you've got to sort of know all the players and the teams and you've got to sort of enjoy watching it because it's, you can't just sit down and watch just for your fantasy players sometimes. So, mostly AFL fantasy. I've tried to dip the toe in here and there, but it's always just come back to AFL for me.
And you're someone who's grown up around the AFL? Like you were an AFL fan first and then found fantasy as an additional sort of thing on top of that? Because I know, like, obviously myself, I was a fantasy basketball player first. I know we had a couple of Poms up the top there last year. So a little bit of that, you know, people coming into the sport a little bit later. You're someone who's been around it for a bit longer.
Yeah, I remember you said that last a couple of episodes ago. You said that you only sort of just been in AFL fantasy. I couldn't believe it, mate, because you seem to be a natural. But yeah, I've always watched footy. I'm a big diehard Port fan. Was back there in 2004 watching the grand final, and yeah, pretty much playing in AFL fantasy a long time. It started just against friends and stuff, bit of fun. Then started to get a bit more seriously, draft leagues and the classics sort of got a bit more serious 4 years ago. So. Yeah, I love it. Love AFL, mate. It's really cool to see people bring in experience from other sports, though. It's nice to see the British boys dominate last year. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe this is a different year. Maybe it'll be someone else's turn.
Yeah, and look, I think the fantasy space is the way we can grow the sport. Shout out to Kane Corns. Like, I think when you have a good game, and I think the AFL fantasy is an excellent game that can bring people from other sports to enjoy the AFL. So, but of course, diehards like yourself who've been around the game for a long time, is, you know, not either way can be successful. So I think that's a really cool thing to celebrate. Let's talk about some strategy. Now, obviously, we're in February. Every person playing with the game at the moment is, you know, fiddling around with their team sort of on the daily. I know I am. But when we go and talk about your starting squad, you're famous for being the value king, the value guy. So this is not necessarily, I guess, breaking news now. It's sort of a well-established strategy for a lot of people. I think Selby kind of coined the strategy back in 2017, but obviously you're someone who's nearly perfected this sort of strategy in terms of hunting for value in every single position. But I wanted to ask you, how do you go about assessing whether or not a player is value heading into the season, and are there certain types of value that are more reliable, that you sort of gravitate to more towards? For example, things like, you know, injury discounts versus role changes versus new clubs or younger players getting better with natural progression. Like, how do you go about assessing a value for a player in the preseason?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think, you know, the way AFL fantasy works is the guys who are cheap for a reason. So you've got to pick the reason sometimes. And there might be multiple reasons why they're cheap. But you have to sort of pick these guys that you think are underpriced, and you think there's value there, and you've got to then hope that they can improve. So I think for me, I'm always looking for a bit of a combo of you know, more than one reason. So if they're injury discounted and they have a role change or a club change, then it's sort of the best of both worlds. You know, maybe looking at things like CBAs, time on ground, that kind of thing. You know, if they're a bit lower 1 year and we expect to see a bump, that's a great way that you can couple that with maybe a little bit of natural progression, and you can get these sort of really big jumps. Because in the end, it's, you know, we see a lot of players improve on their average, but usually it's only a handful, you know, maybe 5 or 10 players that have those crazy, crazy years where they bump up their average massively. They're the ones that I like to sort of make sure I'm on. You know, I'm happy to miss a guy who goes up, you know, 10, 20 points sometimes, but it's the guys that go up 30, 35, 40 plus. They're the ones that I have to start. You know, like a Tristan Cherry last year, I was super big on the two other big ruckmen, and I thought, nah, this Tristan Cherry guy could go crazy. I need to have him as well. So, yeah, not missing out on those, like, massive earners.
Yeah, 100%. And do you subscribe to the fact, like, are you trying to pick every single player in your team out of value, or do you find that you've got room to maybe have like one or two captain options or something like that maybe can, you're happy just to pay fair value for, or are you looking for upside on every single one of your picks?
It is tricky, because if you look for, you know, say you're looking for 10 points of upside on every player, you might end up filling a team and having $2 million left over. So that's normally what I do. I always start the preseason with, you know, a million of cash in the bank. And then the closer it gets to round one, I'll start to sort of go, okay, you know, this guy might not have as much value, but he's a captain option, and I think there's a little bit of meat on the bone there. You know, figure out the best place to spend that cash. You know, maybe it's for team structure reasons, for balance. Maybe there's a captain. Maybe it's a guy who's, you know, certain to be top of the line. You know, it's not something I love doing. I love sort of getting value in every player, but in the end, it's a points. You know, the winner is the team with the most points at the end of the year. So, you know, you can't just leave too much cash on the bench and you'll just fall too far behind to get there.
Yeah, so speaking on that, because we discussed this in one of our more recent podcasts in terms of, maybe intentionally leaving yourself a bit of cash left over in your starting side. Are you someone that likes to, like, spend all of the money? I don't think I've ever gone into a season with more than, I want to say, like, 80K left over in the bank. I usually try it. There's usually something I feel like I can do that can make my team better and spend a little bit more, whether it's a better cash cow or a better captain option or a mid-pricer that I couldn't afford, but if I move this guy down, I can get him. Like, do you like to spend all that cash, or is there a certain number of dollars you like to sort of maybe keep in reserve? Is there anything like that that you sort of live by?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I hear a lot of coaches saying, oh, they you know more than 50K is a waste, but I think almost every year I've gone to the season with at least 100K in the bank. Sometimes 200K, and if I don't have that much, I probably want to have a bit more of an expensive bench, because I think we see every year, you know, there'll be a guy that you miss, maybe a rookie that you miss, or a cheap mid-pricer that you miss who has a massive score. They then go up 80K, 90K in that first week, and if you can't get on them straight away, they're off. So, you know, for me last year it was Ollie Dempsey. Yep. Jumping on him pretty early. If you don't have that cash in the bank, and say you've got a few cheaper rookies on your bench, it can be really hard to get these guys, and they take the season away from you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I suppose it points to that thing where, you know, there's multiple ways to skin a cat. I mean, Ollie Dempsey to me was someone I didn't start with, but, you know, I didn't have the cash, but it obviously forced me to go down to, you know, a Cam McKenzie down to him. And after round one, after that first trade, I did have, I think, something like 200K left over. And I was comfortable with that because I didn't want to miss that Ollie Dempsey, which, like you said, can shoot up in price really, really quickly. So, so is that something you're planning on, the fact that you're not expecting to pick every right position? You're sort of knowing that there's more than likely going to be someone that escapes your starting squad selection, and you're sort of putting in a safety amount of funds, essentially.
Yeah, that's it. I think, you know, it's not something, if I pick a great team that I'm happy with that's got $0 in the bank, I'll do it. But I think, you know, particularly throughout the season, I'm more than happy to keep 100, 200K in the bank, because I think what it does, it just gives you a bit of flexibility the next week. You know, we see, you might say, oh, yeah, I'll start the season. I think, you know, Cam McKenzie to Ollie Dempsey, amazing trade last year, works really well. But sometimes we get, you know, these round ones. I remember, I think it was like 1 or 2 years ago, Josh Kelly got injured in the first round, got concussed. And I was like, great, I've got to trade him. Had another guy that got dropped or injured or something. And then it's like, I've sort of, my outs are sort of fixed. And then sometimes it's nice to have that bit of cash there that you're like, oh, okay, I've got this flexibility then that I can go Josh Kelly up to someone that I'm actually like the look of, rather than just picking someone who fits the salary cap. So I think it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with having all your cash spent, or there's nothing wrong with having, you know, maybe a little bit in the bank. I do love the idea of flexibility, and that's why, you know, I really like to look 1 or 2 weeks ahead. Every year you'll pick someone who's terrible, you'll miss someone who's great. You've got to have that flexibility to correct the bad picks and to bring in the good picks, because if you don't have that flexibility and you miss out on them, you know, they get away super quick. You miss out on points, you miss out on cash gen, and then all of a sudden you get to round five and you're like, why don't I have this guy on my team? Like, how is he ever going to come in?
Yeah. No, 100%. I 100% agree with you. That flexibility and cash obviously gives you that ability to do that. And I agree wholeheartedly when it comes to in-season trades. I know a lot of people have talked about trades and I hear it in other places. And I agree with you where if you make a trade and you're thinking 2 weeks ahead or 3 weeks ahead and you go, okay, I need to bank up this much cash because this guy I want to get, and it's going to be hard to get to him if I have zero in the bank. I think that flexibility the cash gives you is very valuable. When, again, if we're talking about like identifying value in a preseason pick on a certain player, How much do you like to lean on like the data and what the data represents and you know, seeing it, whether it be in smaller sample size and flashes and stuff like that, and seeing it show up in the numbers versus having a gut feel to say, okay, this guy, I think he can take this next step. He can be better than what he's done, but maybe the numbers don't necessarily show it. So examples of to mind this year come up, someone like a Jason Horne-Francis or someone like a Jordan Sweet, where I can sort of go back and I can see the rationale where there's an ability to improve, but I personally can't see it in the numbers to suggest that, okay, when they are given this opportunity, here's what they can do. What are your feels when it comes to like data versus gut feel?
Yeah, I think it's such a tricky balance. And, you know, I've definitely been caught out in previous years of picking guys on sort of gut feel, and generally those are the picks that fail sometimes. But then again, if you lean too heavily on data, they can fail. I think it's, you know, it's just working out what data.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
What are you going to use, and just being consistent to that? So I see, you know, sometimes the classic examples, people go, oh, the final three games, they average this, or the final five games, they average this, the final seven games, they average this. If you go to any player and you pick the right number of games, you're probably going to find a really positive average that you can use. So for me, it's like I use last five, last 10, and that's it. I don't really cherry pick at all. If they have an injured score there or a game where they didn't play that well, too bad. That's sort of in the data, and that's accounted for. I will sometimes go back and look at, you know, maybe games over this much time on ground or over this much CBAs. But you do have to be a little bit careful because, again, you know, some people will use 50%, some people use 40%, 60%. And again, you know, the different ways of cutting the data, you're going to get a smaller and smaller sample size. So, I think that's the first step. You know, for me, I don't consider anyone unless the data sort of looks positive. And then I guess the preseason is the really crucial part. You know, in this role that you see them playing, does the preseason line up with that? So are they playing the role well? Does the coach like them? Who are they competing for that spot? You know, it's all very well to say that they're a good midfielder, but if they've got four better midfielders in front of them, it doesn't really mean anything at all. So I think that's where it's sort of, you've got to piece it together, and don't be afraid to, you know, if it doesn't line up and the coach of their team doesn't think what you think, you have to be willing to sort of cut ties with that player and say, look, the data adds up. At some point, they might be a good pick, but it might not be right now.
Yeah, I've definitely been caught out with that. A lot of the times I sort of think like, I would do this, I would put them here, but obviously I'm not coaching the team, am I? So who am I? I'm just some dude in his spare bedroom talking to a microphone. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what we think, it doesn't matter what we would do. You know, it depends on what we're seeing happen and play out in front of us. We have to go based off that. So sometimes difficult to do, but yeah, I agree with you there. If we talk about, again, how much does a player need to be underpriced to be considered a starting pick? And I think this is a difficult question to ask, but I'm still going to ask it anyway. Because I see a lot of people, I think Jaden's got his worthwhile averages and things like that. And I'm not sure if there's a correct answer year over year, but it's kind of every season is its own thing. But in general, or like, how much does a player need to be underpriced for them to be considered a good pick, and what are some of the nuances in terms of the player's starting price, the position, other competition at that spot that you think influences that?
Yeah, it's a super tricky question, but I think there is, you know, I think a lot of coaches are across the general gist of it, and certainly what I believe is that, you know, that the more expensive players, you need less upside; the cheaper players, you need more upside. Generally what I'm looking for with the, you know, premiums or underpriced premiums, guys that I can see myself keeping all year, I'm looking for sort of maybe just 5 points of upside. Occasionally I might flex that a little bit if I need to, but I'm, you know, I think 5 points is pretty reasonable. And generally you can find that, you know, a guy gets an injured game or maybe, you know, has a bit of a role change for a few weeks when someone gets injured, that kind of thing. So that's probably at the top end. I'm looking for sort of a minimum five. Again, if you can find 10, 15 and they become a premium, they're the kind of picks that win you the car. Five might not necessarily win you the car. And then I think on the bottom end, in terms of rookies, I'm looking at ideally 30 plus points of upside or the ability to go 30 plus. You know, you don't need them all to go 30 plus, but you need to have those guys that could go 35, 40 plus and really shoot up in price really quickly. And then in the mid prices, it's somewhere in between. So, you know, again, it's super, super tricky and it depends a bit on the year. I think, you know, Jaden's worthwhile averages are it's an amazing tool, but we've got to remember that's based on the last couple of years and every year is different. We get different rookies, different injured discounts. We get all sorts of different structures that become viable each year. So I think that's a really good example, but yeah, I think mid prices is somewhere in between that sort of 30 points and 5 points. You know, 20 is a good number, but it depends a bit on how much they cost. Because if it's a guy that might average 100 in the midfield, I'm happy to take a little bit less compared to someone who might average 80. You know, you could almost just go down to a rookie at that price.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, especially when it comes to looking like at a defense this year. A lot of us, rightfully or wrongfully, are finding it difficult to become to sort of, you know, see value that at least value that we're confident in eventuating in the defensive line, you know, that top, you know, mid to top range. So do you think that's like kind of a situation where you would sort of reduce your expectations? You know, maybe you would typically look for sort of like 15 to 20 points of upside in a mid-price or 10 plus points in an underpriced premium. So you, in this early part of the preseason, at least sort of seeing it as though, okay, should I now only be shooting for 5 to 10 points instead? You know, where players like a Bailey Dale or something like that, where, you know, he's probably not going to go up 15, 20 points, but in a normal year, maybe that's what you're looking for. But in this year, when there's not that many other options you're confident in, you're okay with, you know, 5 to 10 points. What are your thoughts on, you know, that kind of line of thinking?
Yeah, the defense is really tricky. And I think, you know, a lot of years that is the case. I'm not exactly sure why, but maybe players are a little bit more stable in their roles but in defense. Whereas, you know, in the forward line, we always get these guys who are, you know, sort of being developed into midfielders and they spend a few seasons in the forward line. Bang, they go into the midfield and they're awesome value. I think, you know, in the end, we have eight minimum defensive positions and you have to fill them with defenders. So it definitely does, you know, you can sort of move the cash around between different lines in your team, but essentially you still have to pick eight guys with defensive eligibility. And if there's not much value, you're going to have to lower your standards a little bit. I think what I will say to this is where I get a bit more flexible with structure. So if you see the value, maybe it's not quite there in defense, you know, that's where I'd look. If I can get a second rookie on field, maybe that's a good play this year if we have good rookie options. Maybe I go a little bit cheaper and just hit those guys that won't be keepers, but there's a little bit of value there. The other option is maybe I just spend the money there because I'm struggling to spend money elsewhere. And then it allows me to get more value in my forward line, in my midfield, that kind of thing. So, you know, in the end, it's we all get the same salary cap and it's who can get the most value across every single line. So if you get a little bit less in defense than everyone else, but you get more elsewhere, then that might be the better play.
Yeah, I think that's it's a simple notion, it's a simple idea, but I think it is where sometimes people can get unstuck. You've got to look at your team as like one, you know, 30 players, right? You can isolate it into your eight defenders and your 10 midfielders and your three rucks or whatever, but comparing players, you know, your defenders compared to your forwards, you know, it's all dollars at the end of the day in terms of this starting salary. So you need to be making the most out of every single pick and comparing that across the board. So I think that's a good thing to remember. I want to talk to you about your rationale and I don't know, maybe this will be a bit of a debate. Look, I'm open to different things, but the 30 green dot philosophy is well known. But you're obviously a very successful coach, and this is something that you do. Now, in my last three seasons, I've started every one of those seasons with a red dot intentionally. I'm not sure if all of those seasons there was an option to go the green. Obviously, last year you started with Sherry on your bench. I opted not to do that. But what is your philosophy when it comes to using 30 green dots, assuming we have a playing R3 this year? Say we do have someone like a Harry Boyd who is playing round one. you would opt to go with all players playing and just hope that the captaincy in that first week works out. Talk to me through that strategy and I guess how married to it are you? Are you open to exploring the red dot loop version of the strategy?
Yeah, it's definitely one that I'm keen on, and it's I have been proven wrong because there's plenty of coaches out there that do really well with the 29 green dots to start with, and I think it's definitely a viable play. You know, I guess the main reason people do it is for the captain loophole.
Yep.
I value having that loophole at sort of 10 to 20 points around. So having the two cracks at the captain gets you maybe, yeah, let's call it 15 points. So if I start with 30 green dots this year, I might lose 15 points to those teams that have that red dot. And, you know, in a given week, that might be terrible. If someone goes massive as a VC, you know, I feel really bad. In other weeks, your VC doesn't fire. You end up taking your captain score anyway. So you essentially have one crack at it. It depends a bit. It's very hard to predict what that's worth, but I sort of say 10 to 20 points. I guess for me, the big reason why I do it is because that cash made at the start of the year, you can then convert that into points that pay back every week. So if you make, say, an extra 200K with that 30th green dot, that's approximately 20 points a game when you cash it in. And then, so you might lose, you know, 10, 15 points here, and here. But then once I cash in that R3 rookie, I'm now making up 20 points a game on those people who started a red dot. It doesn't necessarily line up like that because they still get a trade to maybe drop another rookie as well. And it depends a bit on what kind of value we get mid-season. So if we get heaps of rookies mid-season, you don't actually need the 30 green dots. You know, you can easily get by with 28 or 29. But, you know, in prior years, we have had, occasionally we have some tough years where not many rookies debut mid-season. Maybe they're not great scorers. It's hard to make that cash later in the year. So I think that's sort of roughly my philosophy. I'm not married to it. You know, I'd need to see an R3 that I like the look of. Last year, Cherry, I loved the look of, and I wasn't willing to drop one of the other guys. This year, maybe it depends a bit on what Harry Boyd's doing at St Kilda.
Yeah, I do obviously agree ultimately with that point. Like, if you don't see an option, like, say, you're not big on Harry Boyd, you don't think he's going to play consistently, and that limits his ability to make cash, like, maybe he makes, I don't know, 60K all up throughout the season. Well, I don't believe that to be worth it. But if you think he has the potential to be like a Riley O'Brien back when he was, you know, first introduced, he was a slightly more elevated price, but he went up 300K. Well, obviously that's worth it to have him in your team at that point. But the counter argument to me is, you know, that ability to loop, and with the rolling lockout, you know, the thing that it is, I just find it so valuable. And I know that the common argument for a lot of people is, okay, we've got the buys and then you're going to get red dots anyway. But I would argue the fact that the red dots you accumulate, you know, you choose a specific kind of red dot at the start of the year, you know, someone who's playing a lot of Sunday games, someone who's got a dual position flexibility there. So you have a bit more flexibility. Whereas if you're stuck with a red dot that you didn't necessarily elect to start with, it could be a player that plays Friday night or Thursday night multiple weeks in a row. And then that red dot is actually useless to you. So the ability to choose the red dot, choose that flexibility, I think is also very valuable. What would it take? Let's say a scenario comes here where round one comes along. You put a VC on someone early. What sort of a line would it take for you to go, okay, and again, the caveat is, what's the player that we're putting in instead, or how confident are we in these green dots? But is there a sort of a line where you go, okay, no, I'm going to take this VC score because it's so big that I can't afford to miss it. I'm going to start a red dot just so I can loop this kind of score on.
Yeah, it's a good question. And obviously it really depends on that guy. You know, if we think Harry Boyd's playing and he's going to make 300K, I think I'll be starting 30 green dots regardless.
But what about looking in another line? You know, I know it's always the rucks that we talked about, but what if it's, you know, in the forward line or defense? You know, what if we're not super keen on Isaac Kakko or Joe Berry or something like that? You know, we've got the utility position there as well.
Yeah, I think putting a number on it, it would have to be a massive VC score. And it also depends on who you're rolling into. So that's a big one that, you know, some weeks I'll take a 110 VC score. sometimes I won't even take a 130. You know, last year when Cherry was going on that run, you know, a few weeks I had a 120 something on the loop, and I said, "Nah, I'll just run into Cherry," and he pumps out 160. So you've got to sort of factor in what you're expecting from your captain. You know, if your VC goes 150, but you think you've got a 120 from your captain, that's only 30 points. And then I'm like, well, is that 30 points? Am I better off taking that now, or do I find someone who's got the cash gen and then make it up later? It's a really tricky question. I think it's a great idea you suggest to maybe look at the loophole options elsewhere. You know, defense is a classic example where we always get some spud rookies who just sit yeah. there, play one or two rounds and make no cash. Maybe we're better off just tanking one of those spots and bring your loophole in there. It does get a bit tricky because you've got six guys you're covering for in the defense compared to two in the ruck line. So I'm always a bit hesitant with that option because if you have a late withdrawal, you know, you might not have coverage and then all of a sudden you're fielding 21 one week.
The other option is obviously not only do you have the ability to loop your captain score, but you also have the ability to loop your rookie scores as well. So say, for example, I want to have a Harry Boyd there at R3. He's playing round one, but I still want to have that red dot. I could put someone like, who's his teammate? Is it Max Heath, the other Saints guy?
Yep.
I could put Max Heath in my forward bench because he's ruck forward DPP. Using the utility position, I can put Boyd to my utility. I could put Max Heath to my ruck and loop the captain score through my rucks if I wanted to. But I also have the opportunity to loop my final forward option there as well, because obviously we know early in the season, picking those rookie scores, it's difficult to do. So that gives you an extra swing at that. So I think there's more creative ways that we can go about it than the typical R3 red dot, especially if the options present itself so that is a possibility. Just something that I think maybe people can start to think a little bit more creatively. The last thing to before we move away from this 30 green dot sort of scenario, a couple of years we've had some big scores in round one from these rookies. So like a Nick Martin, his first game pops a 130. I think Kay Chandler did something similar, something close to a 130. We had not to the same extent, but old mate from Geelong, we just said his name before. Ollie Dempsey, sorry, he had like a 90-plus score to start things. And a lot of people might have had these guys on the bench. Would those types of scores sort of tempt you again in terms of starting that red dot to get them on field and have them count if they were sitting on your bench with the emergency on?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I had Nick Martin on the bench whenever he had his debut season.
Years
and
ago or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, had the choice to take a red dot and again decided not to because... it would have made 60 points, but I thought that 60 points would be better made up later in the year with the cash gen from the guy that I would pick, the green dot. And I think that the main thing I do, you know, I definitely love having a red dot at some point in the year. Last year, I brought one in, I think it was round five or round six. I brought in Finbar Marley as my red dot, and he allowed me to do a bit of VC loopholing and emergency loopholing. But I think I love having the flexibility of being able to do that when I want to do that. So, for instance, yeah, you can, if there's a week where there's no rookies and you're going, oh, how do I downgrade? How do I make cash? Where am I going with my trades? That's a perfect week where I can go, oh, great, I'll bring in my red dot now. I know this position is going to give me value because I don't have a red dot. I can make sure it's a guy with the correct fixture for the next few weeks,
yeah.
Make sure I can get those VCs that I want to get. And make sure it's even the correct position. You know, maybe I've got a bit of a depleted forward line. Maybe I bring in a red dot defender, or vice versa. So I think the flexibility really helps being able to bring in that red dot later. And to be honest, last year I brought in probably three or four red dots even close to the end, just so I could loophole players and that extra primo. But yeah, it's a really interesting one. I think it's when do you get those points? You get them at the start of the year? Do you get them at the end of the year? I love coming home with a wet sail. But then again, in 2021, I was 7 points behind the car. So, you know, one of these decisions and I'm walking away with a Hilux. So,
was that the year? Was that the year Nick Martin started off with that 130?
Might have been the year after. I'm not sure how many. That was 4 years ago. So, yeah, okay. Yeah it might have been his year.
Okay. Yeah. I can't exactly remember because I was in that scenario and I went the red dot. I'm not as patient as you. And I said, I'm getting that 130 on my field. Nice. I think I did all right that year. I don't think I didn't win a hat, but I don't think that was... I mean, it's one of those things that's hard to to quantify exactly how much that decision cost you, because it's there's such a domino, such a flow-on effect, and yeah, it's just interesting. Obviously, I don't think that there's one correct way. There's multiple ways you can do it. So I find conversations like these very fascinating. Let's start to go into the season now. So we'll move away from the starting squad. When it comes to the in-season trading, specifically in the early part of the year, do you have like a certain blueprint or structure or plan that you're going through when it comes to sort of say like sort of the first, let's say mid-season buys? Like, is there a certain blueprint you follow when it comes to your trades?
Yeah, so definitely, I think the way I'd sort of break it up is probably those first three or four rounds. I'm looking to sort of fix mistakes, jump on guys that I missed, and really just hunt value. I think again, you know, I look at 100K that I can make as 10 points a game in the future. So if I can cash that 100K in round eight, there's 10 points a game for the rest of the year. You know, that's what 14, 15, 16 rounds. So that's 160 points. So those first couple of weeks, three or four rounds, probably I'm really looking to fix up the guys that I think aren't good value in my team, grab the guys that are. And then I think maybe around that round four, round five, depending on what the rookies are doing, that's when I start to look to get into a bit more of an upgrade, downgrade cadence. So looking at who's maxed out and taking them down to the new rookies, and then trying to use that money for upgrades, however they present. You know, it might be a rookie up to a mid-pricer or a premium. Sometimes it might not be. Keep the rookies on field and take a mid-pricer up to the top. Just depends on where the sort of top line value presents, I think. So, yeah, it's sort of roughly that's what I've done the last couple of years. I'm interested to hear what you normally do in the first couple of rounds of the season.
Yeah, and I have to give credit to Selby because I think he's sort of defined this sort of template that a lot of us do follow now, where you've got your quote-unquote fix-up trades to begin the year where, you know, you want to jump on those mid-prices that pop, whether it is a Matt Crouch or, you know, Jordan Clark or one of those guys, Tom Powell last year. If you missed Tristan Sherry, getting on that really quickly. You know, those first two to three rounds, when you haven't had enough time for the rookies to get fat enough to cull them to make a proper upgrade, I think, yeah, first three or four to five rounds, I think that's where you're going. And then my deadline has always been round six. I want to have made a first, like what I would consider to be a proper upgrade, you know, whether it could be a mid-price up or a rookie to a mid-price or a rookie to an underpriced premium, whatever it is. But I want to have made a one down, one up by round six. Last year, I think I did it a week earlier because we had that accelerated cash gen with the early buys. But that's sort of always been my sort of thing. And then I've always been big on the upgrade cadence from that point on. Like, I want to be making an upgrade every single week during that time while I can. Yeah, injuries can come, you know, and spoil that. So I don't like to avoid that if I can. But if I am trying to make an upgrade every single week, if injuries do strike, then I've at least put myself in a position where, you know, up until that point, I've been pretty aggressive in making those sort of a trades. I want to talk about double downgrades because on a lot of podcasts, it's a bit of a dirty phrase. People don't like to do it. I'm not opposed to it in certain situations. I have done it before and it's worked out for me. And I know you are someone who is a bit of a fan of this as a strategy. When are there certain times where you would opt to do a double downgrade more favorably than others, or is there a certain time where you sort of see it necessary? Does it depend on the rookies coming through? Talk us through the logic on when and why you would be doing a double downgrade.
Yeah, so double downgrading, yeah, it does have a bit of a dirty stigma, doesn't it? But it's something that I think I've done every year the last 4 years, at least once. And normally around that sort of maybe round five to round 10 kind of time frame, because I think that's a lot of the time that's when these rookies who maybe start the year in the VFL, SANFL, WAFL, they get a few games in their belt, you know, they play the role, they learn the team structure, and then the team goes, okay, we've seen enough of them, let's bring them into the team and let's give them a good crack at AFL level. So I think, you know, generally we see heaps of rookies from that sort of round four to round eight kind of range. And yeah, the way I look at it, basically, last year was with the two Gold Coast rookies, Clossy and Graham. If there's two rookies or three rookies even that debut in the same round, and I think, oh wow, these all three of these guys could be great scorers, good job security, good role. I'm keen on all of them. You know, you've only got two trades a week, so if I say I'm only doing one up, one down, I'm gonna have to miss out on one of these guys. Normally, then I'll. What was that?
You're going to miss out on 50K as well. And yeah, if you're going to get in a week later.
100%. Like, yeah, these guys, I think, can jump in. They can put up a fieldable score as well. So, you know, sometimes I think that they're the kind of guys that might put up an 80 or a 90 on debut. That's better than a mid-pricer. And yeah, then I can bring in two of them. And that allows me to do a massive upgrade the next week. So what I'll do with that cash, you know, I might bank 300, 400K. And then next week, I'm taking like a pretty poor rookie and turning them into a top line midfielder, captain option, you know, bang, just give them the VC or the C straight away. I think it's been really effective for me because sometimes I think we get stuck. We concentrate on an upgrade and end up getting a guy that you don't really like. Maybe there's not much value there. Maybe it's just like, oh, I'll just get him for 2 weeks and I'll trade him on. I'd much rather around that time, if there's no one I like, I'll just take two guys down, bring in two good rookies. And then it means I can get the guy that I definitely want next week, particularly if I've got a guy lined up. You know, like last year, it was the Nick Dacos. You know, everyone was sort of looking to jump on him at the right time. There's always a premium who's just absolutely right for the picking in that week with a good matchup. They're hard to get to, but maybe a double downgrade helps you get there.
Yeah, it's very interesting you sort of mentioned that timeline because I don't try to make a habit of like intentionally trying to do it, but I do find that week before the upgrade season starts is when I want to do it. So I usually target that week and the first week of the buys as the 2 weeks that I will allow myself to do that because it's sort of like you're gearing up ready to get that cadence underway and, you know, you're banking some cash so that, okay, after this week, every single week I'm going to be able to make that cash and I'm also not going to force myself to skimp on the player that I want, which is what you said before. So while others might be chasing sort of that mid-pricer that might sort of be a little ride you can take for 5 to 6 weeks, I don't usually love to do those kind of moves because they have an expiry date and sometimes getting off them is just as difficult as, you know, trading them in. So I try to avoid those headaches where I can and I agree like you that, you know, if timed properly and if the right rookies present and you're sort of at that area where it's not quite a proper upgrade you can make, sort of that week four, week five, that double downgrade can be a way to kind of put you in that position to do so. So that's interesting.
I think I love how you say expiry date, mate, because I think that's incredible. You know, like last year we saw it with Luke Jackson, you know, there was, he had an expiry date and that expiry date just lines up perfectly with when we want to be upgrading, downgrading rookies. So anyone who has that expiry date, particularly sort of like round five to maybe the start of the mid-season buys, really, really tricky to bring those guys in because that when you have to trade them out, guess what? You know, you might miss out on a rookie. You might miss out on an upgrade elsewhere. If they have an expiry date at their mid-season buy, then I'm much more inclined, particularly if they're not in that first week. That's great. You know, we saw last year with Crisp and Will Day, really good trades. Yep. They expired at their mid-season buy, and that's perfect. But with other guys, you know, I hate getting that sort of halfway guy because he's going to cost you a trade down the line just when you need that trade.
Yeah, 100%. Like some examples I can think of the past few years, you know, there was a couple of the Suns players that there were options.
Fiorini,
the rat pasta. That option, like, yeah. I avoided both those players that year because it's that type of player that I hate to do. It was sort of the logic to why I didn't trade in Riley Bonner last year. I was worried that he was potentially... Now, he probably was a great pick and one that I missed, but I was happy enough to go against it because I had a Matt Crouch there. I had Nick Martin in my side. I had the three rookies in my midfield that I was pretty comfortable with in Matt Roberts and the likes there. I had a couple of underpriced premiums. So I didn't feel like I was missing out on a good pick in Riley Bonner because my structure was set up that way. Which brings me to my next question in terms of in that early part of the season and those first fix-up trades, how much are you taking into account, you know, structure and things like that. So that example that I just gave with last year, the midfield, Matt Crouch, Nick Martin, all of those other players caused me to miss Riley Bonner, but I was okay with it because I felt like I had other people that could combat that offset in value? And how much are you trying to restructure on the fly there if you feel like necessary?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example, and it's incredible that you had a pretty good season without Bonner there, because he was really a great earner for us early on. I think, I do like to be flexible with my structures. So rookies is one that, a lot of people are trying to get off your field. I am one that I normally always have a week where I get an extra rookie on the field, because I'm happy to get rid of two mid prices, take one down to a rookie, one up to a premium. And likewise, I'm not, if you get an injury, I think a lot of the first thought is, oh, I'll just trade to someone else who's a similar price in that line. I'm very happy to trade a premium in defense to a rookie, and then a rookie in forward line up to a premium, if that's the best value I can get in that given week. Knowing that you can always correct in the week or two afterwards, it's not, because of the way the upgrade cadence works, there's a period there where you're almost getting a premium on field every single week. Mm-hmm. So if it means that I have to upgrade in defense next week, that's fine. I can do that. Maybe just have a bit of a look forward of who the targets are coming up. I think probably the one thing that I do look at is, like your bench strength. Do I have a guy that can cover a 1 or 2 week injury? Do I have two red dots just sitting there, waiting for me to have a donut sometime? And then also, where am I up? If I fully upgrade my defense and then a really good mid-pricer or rookie pops up, I can't really jump on them. So having that flexibility to build sort of upgrade fairly evenly, so that if a guy pops, in my really popular year, really successful year in 2021, I brought in Jeremy Sharp quite late, and he was a rookie on field that no one else really had rookies on field, but he was pumping out 80s, 90s, a couple of hundreds for me, and that really shot me up because it meant that I could keep him on the field and then just get the uber premiums elsewhere, which made up those points. So I think that's, being flexible with structure, I think, is really important. And remember, we change our structure every week. You get two trades every week. Your structure for 1 week doesn't have to be the structure you roll with for the next 10 weeks.
Yeah, 100%. I think, again, the common theme of this podcast seems to be like that flexibility, having ability to be flexible, adjust and readjust, very, very vital. When you mentioned injuries there, and I want to go through that link a little bit more. When you get an injury during that upgrade cadence sort of time of the year, are you someone that likes to hold a 1 week, 2 week injury? Is there a sort of a line where you go, okay, if I think it's going to be a 2 week injury, I'm trading. If it's a 1 week, I'm holding. Is it maybe 3 weeks for you? What? Because that can be a tricky question. Obviously, some people have been burnt before with like the Tom Green sort of situation, the Connor Rosie situation last year, where trading them would have been the right idea. But just as easily in the past, sometimes holding is the right play. I think Matt Crouch even missed. He might have missed a week with suspension, and the right call was to probably hold him. It can be a tricky situation. But do you have I guess a rule or something when it comes to those types of scenarios?
Yeah, generally, I think as a coach, I'm probably more on the side of holding guys than a lot of other people are. So, I held Green and Rosie through the horrible patch last year and just was just pulling my hair out through all of it. But I think, I think definitely 1 week I'm more inclined to hold. 2 weeks is a bit of a gray area. Depends a bit on the injury. Do I think they're going to come back fully fit? Or do I think it might take them a few weeks to come back to full strength? So, that depends a bit on the injury. If it's just a mild hamstring, you go, he might need 2 weeks and then he'll be back to full strength. If it's a, maybe a shoulder or something a bit more, impact, that you see with guys like Sicily, they do their shoulder and they're just different players afterwards. So it depends a bit on the injury. Suspensions are an easy one because you pretty much know they're going to be coming back full fitness, maybe even fitter. So I love holding a guy with a 1 or 2 week suspension because they just get 2 weeks off and they come back and they can smash out the year.
Does it depend on the player as well? Like, is it like, for example, so I had Matt Crouch last year. He got suspended and I traded him out. My rationale for trading him out is because I didn't know whether or not I truly thought of him as a player that was a guy I wanted to hold. It was an opportunity for me to get onto Sam Walsh, I think, at the time, who was popping, who wasn't. I think I actually might have even made some cash. I can't remember exactly, but does the quality of the player make a difference when making those decisions, whether they be sort of someone you want to keep long term, someone who's maybe eventually going to go out of your side as it is?
Yeah, 100%. So I think the anytime it's a, you know, mid-price, a rookie that gets a week off or gets injured, maybe gets a vest. You know, we had like Riley Sanders is a great example, getting a vest on a Thursday night and you go, oh, I've got an option to get off here. You know, do I trade him before he gets the 30? I think it's very, very different with a guy that you're not expecting to hold for the year. So you're going to trade them at some point. Maybe they make another 50K, 100K. You've just got to do the math on you know how much value is left there. And if they're pretty close to the top, you might be better off just saying, yep, get rid of this guy. I'm going to trade him 2 weeks early, but I'm going to get an extra score on field from whoever I bring in. With the premiums, it's more, I like to sort of hold that 1-2 weeks. 3 weeks is probably where I say, yeah, definitely trade. It depends a bit as well. What else are you doing that week? You know, if there's a guy that you can, if you can use the cash and there's a guy you love with a bit of upside, then it might be a good trade. But if you've got two other great trades to do anyway, you know, a lot of the time I look at it, I might still get the upgrade I want either way. So then I'll just hold. Maybe that 2 week injury only cost me for 1 week. Yeah. So.
Yeah, 100%. I think it is very individual and it's hard to put a blanket rule on it, but I think we align it in that sort of a thinking. Last one on these upgrade sort of questions. When it comes to sort of like identifying a target, what are you looking at and is there a priority list on what you're looking for? Are you looking for, you know, how much they're priced at under what you expect them to do, the matchups coming up, you know, is there a reason that a player is cheaper that you like better than other reasons? For example, like maybe they got tagged early on and that's why their price is down, or versus maybe they had an injury several weeks ago but they're back now. Like, is there what sort of are the key things you're looking for that makes a trade target?
Yeah, I think there's so much to consider, but I think the big one that I look at, particularly in that sort of round five to the mid-season buys kind of area, I love a discounted premium. So someone that I think is valued, but someone that I also think I can hold for the whole year. So it's sometimes tricky to work out, you know, who is going to be top of the line, but at least if they're a top line player, I think they're going to be close enough. I love bringing them in, and because it just saves you a trade down the track. That's probably the first one I look for. Obviously, yeah, you've got to look for value and why that value is. I think, a tagged game, an injured game, they're probably the two more common reasons. Maybe they've just had a tough run of fixtures.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time, if you look at a guy, I love doing this, you know, Bontempelli, I think it was 2 years ago, he had like a really hard start to the year, went at like 100 over the first 4 weeks or something. And everyone thought, oh, that's disappointing. It's Bontempelli, blah, blah, blah. He had an incredibly tough run and then it opened up. And so I got on him, I think before he even pumped out 120, brought him in and he just went on an absolute tear. And that just really sets you up because, you can see the fixture. You can see what it was before and you can see what it was afterwards. If they've had a really tough fixture, guess what? At some point it's going to open up. And that's when you can get these guys that are captain options as well. So I think... Yeah, definitely. You've got to sort of look both ways. I also love bringing that guy for that instant reward. So when they have that sort of premium that has that juicy, juicy matchup, I love getting on that, giving them the VC or the C on debut, because that's just an easy way to sort of get the leg up on everyone else. You know, maybe other teams haven't bought them in yet. You get to double their score the first week, and that just really shoots you up the rankings.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that separates a successful coach and people who always find themselves chasing the pack is not needing to wait to see that score to jump on a player. Like, if you can see the potential for a big game and they haven't done it yet, they've had a disappointing run up to that point, but they haven't had that pop score, and you go anyway because you're confident in your research, you're confident in the run that they've got coming up. You know that they're obviously a good player, like Bontempelli, Nick Dacos last year. Like, we shouldn't have many doubts about these types of players and their ability. But a lot of people sometimes want to wait and see the score first. And I think that kind of mindset just will always have you kind of a little bit behind the eight ball a little bit. Now, sometimes it is good to be patient on maybe some more risky type players, but those kind of guys, I think launching ahead of the pack is a good way to get yourself in front, which is obviously what we're all aiming to do. Let's talk about some buy rounds. So how much in the preseason do you consider both, we'll lump them together, but the mid-season buy and the early buy? Obviously, we've only had one season with the early buys so far, but just in general, when you're putting together your starting squad, do you look at the early buys or the mid-season buys much at all?
Yes, maybe we'll start with the mid-season buys because that's been around for the last 4 years. So I think definitely I have a quick look, probably in the week leading up to locking my team in. So just have a look at particularly those players who you expect to still be there and to you actually want to keep through the buys. So those guys you think are going to be top of the line or close to, and just make sure you don't have too many from one buy round, particularly in the same line as well. So, you know, I don't want to start three top defenders who all have the same buy, because that's just, you know, basically guaranteeing that I'm going to be playing with 21 one of those weeks. Maybe I'm better off bringing one of them in after their bye, and then I can still have them, you know, in that period. So that's, you know, I don't, again, we get so many injuries. You know, one of these guys you might trade out. Mid prices and rookies, I'm not too bothered with the mid-season buys because they're probably all going to leave my team then anyway, or I'll probably trade them on their bye, ideally. So I think that's probably where I look at with the mid-season buys. Is that sort of roughly how you're heading it this year?
Yeah, I think so. I do like to, if there's a premium option that has that, you know, in the last few years, we've had a round in particular in mid-season where there's been the good buy, you know, the buy that's only had two teams on it. This year it's St Kilda and Frio. So I do like to, if there is a player there, and I'm still following my normal rules in terms of looking for value, looking for those sort of things, but if there is a player on those teams that fits those other rules, I do favour those players a little bit more strongly. You know, this year, you know, Andrew Brayshaw, I'm pretty big on because he satisfies that need because it just makes the other buyers so much easier. And I do want to get your thoughts on like stacking the buys, the mid-season buys, either junior trades or in the preseason, whichever way. Like, do you, because the old method when there was three buys, it was the 8-10-12. The idea was you'd stack it a bit more heavy in the back end so that you'd get more and more as you go along and pass their buy. Do you have a similar kind of strategy, or are you a bit more like myself? I just like to keep things even. I don't mind if it's early or late. Everyone's going to miss one game. What are your thoughts with that kind of a structure?
Yeah, I think in the past, I've definitely aimed for sort of roughly even. But to be honest, I think having that sort of weighted towards the end is probably the better move. I think the way it's just turned out, I've just brought in guys who have had that first buy. We've got to remember though, you know, this year we've got five buy rounds in the mid-season. You know, you're going to be able to do probably four upgrades between that first buy round and the last buy round, maybe even five. You've got three trades a round. So trades. Your team's going to be much, much better in round 16 than it is in round 12. Yep. So I think that, to me, says, well, actually, you probably do need a few more people on the buy later, because that round 12 team, you might be covering it with a 60, whereas in round 16, you know, your lowest score might be 80 or 90 on field. So I think that's probably the first point. The second point, I think the St Kilda Freo one's really interesting this year because, yeah, on paper, there's only two teams on that buy. So we should theoretically have less players on the buy round. But when you look at Freo and St Kilda and some of the guys that people are starting, you know, I reckon I've got, that's probably the buy round where I might even have the most premiums at the moment in my team. So, you know, there's guys like Brayshaw, Jack McRae, a lot of people are starting, you know, the Saints defenders, a lot of people are starting, and, you know, probably looking at maybe a Rowan Marshall as an early upgrade. All of a sudden, you've got four or five players on that buy round. I think it probably, realistically, we'll get to the mid-season buys, and that won't be the tricky round. That won't be the easy round. There'll actually be another one with, you know, Geelong or Gold Coast or something where no one has any of those players. So I think it's good to have, but I'd be a little bit careful around that because, if you get three or four guys from St Kilda Freo straight away, and then, you know, say Caleb Sarong gets injured on five, becomes really cheap for us, are you going to bring in a sixth? You know, what if Rowan Marshall starts slow? Are you going to bring in a seventh? All of a sudden, you're sort of saying, I can't touch Rowan Marshall at his juicy, juicy price. We just got to try and spread it out, I think, as evenly as possible initially, And then closer to the buy rounds, the mid-season buys, you can start to sort of finesse which premiums you bring in.
That's a very good point you bring up there, because I agree, like Frio and St Kilda are two of the more relevant fantasy teams, I think, this year. So it might seem easy on the surface, but yeah, you might end up having a lot of those players. Let's talk about the early buy rounds, though. Obviously, it's newer. I don't think anyone can confidently say that they know exactly how the optimal strategy is. But at this stage, with one season under your belt, how did you approach it last year? And do you think that you did it the right way? And is that going to be something you attempt to do this year? Because it is slightly different with one fewer rounds, one round where there is obviously now four teams on the bye. How are you approaching those in the second year that it's been installed?
Yeah, so last year, I think, like a lot of coaches, I was pretty happy to take rookies and some mid-prices on each of the buy rounds, relatively even spread. And I tried to avoid those premiums. You know, I did start Whitfield because I thought he was great upside and I just didn't know who else to pick. Heaney, Grundy, Gawn, those sorts of guys, I was happy to start because, again, I just thought that they're too good a value to pass up. I think what I do is I just sort of discount them by a few points per game, or their value by a few points per game, because I know they're going to miss. So, again, you know, I'm looking at points over the season. If I lose, say, 40 points when they have their bye, then they need to be 40 points better than the alternative for that whole season or however long they're going to be in my team for. So, you know, Gawn was one where I was like, oh, he's going to miss. I'm going to lose 50 points. But I think he's 5 points of upside better than the alternative. Yeah. So you start him, he makes it back in 10 games. And, you know, as it turned out, he probably made it back in the first six games because he started absolutely yeah. mental. He probably scored more points than the alternative, even with his bye. Yeah. So, you know, that kind of thing, I think you just take a bit of a discount there. It depends who your other option is, though. You know, it's a classic, you know, if we have a perfectly good option who doesn't have the bye, you have to pick them. But if it's, if it's Max Gawn's 10 points better but has the bye, well, I'm going to pick Max Gawn. He's going to make it back.
Yeah, 100%. What are your thoughts about these strategies? Like, for example, I'm getting my pommies mixed up. I can't remember. Was it Tom, I think, that started the Tom Green, or Chris? I think it might have been Chris. Chris started the Tom Green, and then with the intention of trading him after his first couple of rounds. What are your thoughts on those types of strategies? Obviously, we're in that. We talked about before, like the fix-up trade being that type of area. It is a period where you're not making upgrades. What are your thoughts on those type of, I would call them aggressive strategies of buy round flipping and those sort of things? Do you see that as something that you'd be interested in exploring, or do you find yourself being a bit more conservative?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I've got Tom lined up on my own podcast, and that's one of the questions I want to ask him. I think he did. He might have done it as well. Maybe I've got them confused, but I think for me, the trade, trades are worth something. We've got to remember trades are worth something. And to me, it's at least 100K in the early season that trade's worth. So you could say, oh, you know, they start strong, they make 80K, and then I trade them. But you're giving up a trade on someone else. So you might be able to trade that guy who's stunk and has just been in your team and you can't get rid of them fast enough. I think whichever one it was got a bit lucky because they had such a great starting side that was a perfect trade for them. But, you know, most coaches, they're going to have at least 4, 5, 6 issues that you want to get rid of. And I don't like banking a trade, like committing to a trade that early in the season, particularly if it's one play. You know, that was like Tom Green is definitely leaving my team in round two or round three. If you've got, say, 5 players and you say, well, I'm going to trade one of these 5, that I think is a bit better because that, you know, that then at some that point you'd expect one of those guys to maybe have maxed out on price, mm-hmm. maybe not be a good pick. I'm a bit happier doing it with a few different players rather than just committing to trading one guy.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree. Now, whenever someone wins a car or comes second, we're going to get to this Pommy mystery one day or another. But when someone has a season like that, you stop and question yourself and you go, okay, hold on. Am I being stubborn about this? Am I missing something? Were they lucky or were they just ahead of me? So I am obviously open to exploring it, and it's something I'm thinking about. And even like I've looked at the Port Adelaide midfield run to start the year. I believe they start with 3 great matchups, and you know that coincides with then, you know, a Tom Green who I think is undervalued. You know, he's going to come off his buy at that sort of a point. So these kind of things are floating around through my mind. But like you, I don't love to bank a trade there that I have to make. But I think it is at least an option that we have that maybe, you know, having it there as a possibility is something that I think is at least worth exploring. So, yeah, very, very interesting. Last little area of the year that I want to talk about, it is the part of the year that I hate the most, luxury trading. Every single, or my last 3 years, 2 years, I came out of the buy last year fourth. In 2022, I came out of the buys 21st. That year, I didn't win a hat. I completely fumbled. I was out of the top 10 last year, obviously. So I don't have the greatest relationship when it comes to luxury trading season. So how do you approach that period after the buy round? Because this is in your years has been the strength. You've come home with a wet sail, like you said before. What's your strategy been in these final sort of eight or so rounds in the back half of the year?
Yeah, it's such a tricky time of the year, and I'm with you there, mate. I've normally have a pretty good record coming home strong, but I still make some terrible trades in that luxury trading season. I think we all do, you know. So last year I traded out Dylan Moore right before his run, and then brought him back in a couple of weeks later. You know, that kind of thing does happen sometimes. I think, you know, the beauty of the team value strategy, or really chasing the value early, is that you get to your team value to the point where you start locking away these guys at the top of the line, and then, you know, by the time you get to that luxury trading season, you've got the best players, and you can just play around with those sort of, maybe, you know, borderline top players. They can be the ones that you're burning trades on. So I think that's the key, you know, definitely locking in as many of those top players that you can. You know, I'm talking guaranteed top of the line players. They're the ones that I think, if you can lock them in early, it just means you've got a bit more flexibility later. You know, I guess the big thing that people do is, you know, fixture chasing. And I think fixture chasing is something that earlier in the year I really don't like to do at all. Because if you have a good run of fixtures early, guess what? That's going to, you know, we all have to play every team at least once. You know, there's a few teams that you play twice, but that's meant to be fairly equal. So early in the season, I think fixture chasing is kind of pointless. Later in the season, it does open up for some of these guys. You know, we see, particularly 4 or 5 weeks to go, we see guys have crazy good matchups.
Yeah.
And they just go berserk. So I love to bring in those guys, identify probably after the midseason buys who has a good run home, you know, using this year's data, not last year's data, you know, the current roles, and then look at, you know, how can I get all of those guys in my team for their good run? So maybe that means jumping a week early. Mm-hmm. Maybe that means missing the first week and then jumping on the fixture afterwards. And then just doing that. You know, I personally haven't been amazing at this. You know, I've definitely left points on the table, but I think if you have that team value high enough, you have a little bit of cash on the bench that you can use. It just gives you that bit of flexibility to not sacrifice, because I think, that's the kind of time of the year where you don't want to be taking the cheaper guy. You want to be taking the guy that's definitely got the run, definitely got the role. They're the guy that you're almost certain on. That's the guy you want to be bringing to your team.
Yeah, 100%. I think the next question I've got here I'm interested in your thoughts as well, because it's the first year that I am aware of that we started to see the 23rd and in some cases the 24th premiums enter sides. It has been a thing that, and I'm no super coach player, but I follow it a little bit. It's something that we see over in super coach in the limited trade format, where obviously if you have an injury, you have a player there that's at least competent to sort of fill that void. But we saw it come into AFL Fantasy with the more difficult to predict forward line. But even in Chris's example, where he had a ninth premium midfielder, do you think, or can you foresee this becoming the go-to strategy this time of the year? Or do you think that it's going to be a bit more of a 2024 thing where it just the stars aligned? Or do you think that this is something that we should look at in the next coming years?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that was relevant last year. And you know, maybe it was just an easy year for value. We had some great ruck options. You know, you almost couldn't miss in the ruck lines. We had some really great options around the ground. We had some really good rookies who just went up huge amounts of cash. You know, is that happening every year? I think, you know, in previous years, it was probably tricky to get that 23rd primo. You know, even in my sort of best years, team value was absolutely massive. I never really got to the point where I had a 23 primo, not a fully fledged one, maybe one that was, you know, just that sort of tier below the top tier guys. And this year, again, yeah, I think, you know, you look at the ruck line alone, we have way less value in the rucks this year than we did last year. So there's, you know, two spots that are going to be pretty tricky to make a heap of cash out of. Depends a bit on what happens with the forward line. If we don't pick up any DPPs and we have quite a cheap top six forwards, I think that really helps with the 23rd primo. But yeah, it's definitely something that you should be considering. I think all coaches should be considering. If you do well earlier in the year and you've got that value up, you might say, look, I'm happy with this 22 that I've got. Now's the time to bring in a 23rd guy and do some clever trades, clever looping. You've got to be very, very careful with it, though, because that's one of those things that if you commit to a 23rd primo, you're going to be staring at your phone all weekend. You're going to be checking the time, game times, and changing your trades. And we saw, I think, with a few of the teams in the top 10 last year, I think we saw a few, you know, made a mistake with that 23rd primo. Yeah. And it cost them maybe 80 points, 60 points, whatever it was. So
I think it was Chris yeah. that had Peatling locked on his field, I think, one of the weeks. And lucky it didn't cost him, but... it can be tricky. And talk about, like, there's so many decisions you have to make in AFL fantasy. You know, do I take this VC score? Do I loop this rookie? What are my trades that I'm making? Am I being aggressive? And especially that end of the year, if you're at the top there, like, what's this team doing? What's this team doing? And then to add in a 24th, 23rd premium in there, and what's the line I take? Like, you know, if they score 100, is that good enough? Am I chasing that? It is... I can see the downsides of it as well, but... obviously proven last year that it did seem to work out. I can see a scenario this year where, you know, you said last year we had the cheap rucks and sort of give me picks. Well, this year I can see that in the forward line. I also think that the early season buys and that accelerated cash gen, you've also got an extra mid-season buy round as well this year. So you've got an extra trade there. That I can foresee that team value getting to that point potentially again. And the thing that I think a lot of us need to remember is to get that 23rd, 24th premium, it doesn't just happen. Like, it's not something that you just wake up one week and you go, okay, yeah, I'm going to trade in the 23rd premium. A lot of the times you've got to put the groundwork in, and maybe it's a Connor Rosie that presents around the buys who's super underpriced, and you go him instead of, you know, someone who's a bit more expensive in order to save a bit of that cash for the next week for you to get that 23rd premium in. So it is something that I'll be... considering as we get close to that thing. If anything else, not to, you know, to avoid trading out Tristan Sherry again like I did last year and making those kind of mistakes, at least then I can feel like I sleep at night and not kick myself for making trades like that. So maybe it's just a psychological benefit at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, if a guy has the beauty of the 23rd primo is, you know, if a guy like Sarong, for instance, is, you think he's going to get tagged one week and you're expecting a poor score, you know, if you've got 22 primos, all of a sudden you've got to trade him out to avoid that score. Whereas if you have the 23rd, you bring in someone, maybe not a top of the line player, but you bring in someone in your midfield who can cover for him for a week, or maybe you take a look at Sarong and you go, yep, that's a 60. I don't want that on my field. And then it just means that then, you know, you're not trading Sarong out for one week. You can leave him in the team and then, you know, convert that extra primo to a different line next week to cover for another tough matchup. So it's great. If you do it really well, it's a great way to make up points, particularly with a few red dots, and you can take a look at scores. But yeah, I think you're right. You know, if you're going top of the line every time and getting the guys in that are really great players and expensive, you're probably not going to have the cash to do this option. You're going to have to take a haircut on a few different upgrades to make sure you have the cash for the 23rd, 24th primo.
Yeah, 100%. So we'll see what 2025 brings us. I'm very excited for things to get going, and that'll bring us down to this podcast, mate. Thank you so much for jumping on. You've given us a lot of your time. Very much appreciated. And this is a fantastic chat. I'm definitely going to go back and re-listen to this and see all the nuggets of gold that you dropped us. Now you have some very exciting news for us. For anyone who enjoyed this podcast, enjoyed the conversation we have, you're launching a new podcast, which is basically going to be every episode similar to this one, where we're deep diving on strategy, what I like to call the teach a man to fish philosophy. Tell us more about what's coming down the line for 2025 for DT Lemon.
Yeah, that's it, mate. So yeah, I love strategy chats, and the Lemon League is what it's called. We're just going to be purely strategy focused. So we're not going to tell you who to pick. We're going to teach you how to pick them round on round, year on year, and hopefully make you guys better AFL fantasy coaches. So it's live now. It's just gone live this week. First strategy episode is with the GOAT, Selby. So that's a really great chat. I've also got a team reveal up there, and I've got a few more guests lined up as well with some really special topics. So we'll go into a bit more detail that you can't sometimes do when you're talking about several things in a podcast. So yeah, you can find it at lemon_league on X, and there's links there to the Patreon. Or you can find me at lemon_DT and I'll send you in the direction. So yeah, hopefully if you like this, you should like what we're doing over there.
Mate, it's hard to go wrong with starting your first podcast with the Goat Selby on. And I 100% will be jumping on straight after this podcast and signing up myself. Very interested in diving into that. So make sure you do check out DT Lemon on social media and his Patreon there for some great podcasts all year round. I'm 100% sure of it. Thank you very much for jumping on the podcast today, mate. Enjoyed the chat as always. And if you guys enjoyed the chat, please make sure you go ahead and give this video a big old thumbs up on YouTube. Give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you also enjoy our podcast, you can go ahead after you've subscribed to the Patreon over at DT Lemon. You can subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/theballboys. Get your preseason projections, get the blueprint for the top 100 season, get into our cash league for Patreon members exclusively, and lots of other details. We are going to be doing some reviews of the match sims coming up exclusively for our members, which we're very excited to do, which is just next week, guys. But until next time, we'll catch you guys later. Bye.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.